Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. This week, Steve Satan on Pirate Radio and also Julie Beale on Smart IDs. Dialect is produced by volunteers. If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol, whose office is just off Queen Square. And I'll give you the phone number and website for Volunteering Bristol at the end of the show. So I'm joined by Steve Satan now, who's also a presenter here on BCFM. But this time, you're being grilled. You're not doing the grilling for a change.
Yeah, it makes a change, doesn't it?
It does. And the reason is because you've actually got quite a lot of experience in pirate radio, in the later days of pirate radio. But tell us, what is pirate radio and what was it?
Well, it was, and indeed still is. Like, pirate radio is radio that doesn't have a licence. And therefore is beyond the control of the authorities who license radio stations.
It still happens. We've got a pirate station in Bristol, I think, haven't we?
Well, they've given up FM. They've realised that the web is the way to go, and I think a lot of pirates are still doing that. Although FM is still, you know, a widely used medium, and in most of the major cities you'll still hear plenty of pirate stations across the FM band, particularly in London.
I know, yes, and in fact, sometimes if you're driving in and out of London on, I think it's usually Sundays, you can hear loads and loads of these FM, little FM stations. Passion FM is Bristol's pirate, so that's only online now, is it?
Yeah, well, it's totally legit then, isn't it? It's not a pirate anymore.
Well, okay, so the pirates are dying out. But why did they start in the first place? Around about 1964, what was the point of it all?
Well, you can go back even further if you like. The bottom line is when someone isn't providing a radio service and someone else wants to provide a service. Now, that could be just for commercial reasons, just to sort of spread entertainment across the masses, or for propaganda purposes, you can set up a pirate transmitter. And I think there is a history of the United States putting a pirate radio station on a ship and broadcasting propaganda, I think, in the 40s or 50s.
Well, this is almost used by the military, is it? To propaganda, say, for example, over Vietnam, you know, give up on your government. Your government's no good, you know, this kind of thing.
Indeed, yeah, yeah. I mean, well, that's been going on for years and years. Shortwave international broadcasting, of course, because shortwaves know no international barriers, and they tend to go around the world very well, but they're not great for broadcasting music. And then in the sort of, I don't know, the 20s, when radio was being invented, some enterprising people put radio stations in France, broadcasting across the channel to the UK to provide popular music that the BBC wasn't providing. And that situation carried on right up until the 60s. And what's interesting about the 60s, of course, is that there was this great boom in British popular music, the British invasion. You know, you had the Kinks, the Stones, you know, the Beatles, of course.
To be fair, it was happening in the States as well, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah, of course. But that's the relevance to the British music scene and British pirate radio. So you've got, you know, pop music is extremely exciting. And if you want to hear this sort of music, you can't really. You can
buy the record, can't you?
Well, you can do. But people, you know, like to listen to their music all day long. And
so what was the BBC like at the time? I think it was the home service, they used to call it. And did they just decide, well, this is not the kind of stuff for us to ever play?
Yeah, they had this thing called the Light Programme, which was a kind of the precursor to Radio 2, and it was a sort of easy listening hell, really.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, so it's the Light Programme.
Yeah,
and
the home service became Radio 4.
Right, that was a speech base, and the Light Programme was music.
That's right, yeah. And they also had the Third Network, which became Radio 3.
So why not? Why didn't the BBC play some of this pop music on the Light Programme then?
I think they did a little. There was about an hour a day of a programme called Midday Spin or something, you know, maybe one or two other programmes. But it was basically snobbishness. They thought that this was a fad that was going to pass. It was dreadful racket, you know, and we just ignore it, it'll go away. And of course it didn't. And there was also Radio Luxembourg, which for years had been broadcasting from Luxembourg to the UK in English, broadcasting popular music. But that you could only get that at night, and the signal faded in and out, and it was, you know, pretty
poor. That's right. Actually, medium wave is very good at night, isn't it? You can pick up, say, you know, stations you would never normally hear at night for some reason on medium wave.
Yeah, well, they bounce off the sky at night, so they go further. But it's a double-edged sword, because that gives you the extra interference at night.
And that was someone in Luxembourg, was it? Who just thought this is a little commercial enterprise. The Brits aren't getting this music, so we'll put it on Luxembourg and
Well, start. I mean, yeah, it was more than one guy. I think it was, you know, heavily backed by big business and the government in Luxembourg. And in RTL today, Radio Télé Luxembourg, remains a very, very powerful broadcaster with loads of TV stations in Germany. So, yeah, Luxembourg have been doing it for years, but obviously it was only available at night. So this enterprising Irishman, amongst others, decided that it was Ronan O'Reilly, his name is. He realised that if you put a radio station on a ship and put your ship just outside the 3-mile limit where British laws don't apply because you're outside British territorial waters, you can broadcast with impunity. And lo and behold, Radio Caroline was launched on Easter Sunday 1964 with this diet of music all day. Its tagline was... This is Radio Caroline, your all-day music station. And not surprisingly, it was hugely successful.
So how long did it run for? I mean, because it's based on a ship. Another thing is, were there problems with the ship? I mean, for example, in a storm?
Yes, and the answer is Radio Caroline is still going. Radio Caroline has come and gone in many forms over the years, but it's now broadcasting as an internet station and up until very recently on satellite as well. But the glory days were the 3 years between 1964 and 1967. In 1967, or prior to 1967, the government introduced a law called the Marine Offences Act. That was Tony Benn, actually, behind that.
Interesting, isn't it? Bristol MP. And it's supposed to be a bit of a radical, but when these people get into government, often they turn a different direction, don't they?
It's interesting. I did actually challenge him about it. I met him a couple of years ago and asked him. And he said, you know, he wanted to be remembered as the person who launched Radio 1. I suspect he was feeling a bit guilty about it. I think, you know, he probably realised that he shouldn't have done it, you know.
Pressurised, possibly, by civil
indeed,
servants.
Yes, indeed, yeah, very likely, yeah. And I think Harold Wilson was dead against it as well at the time. So he brought that act. And what that act did...
When you say Wilson was against it, he was against the Marine Offences Act?
No, he was against pirate radio. So he,
why? Why were these... I mean, well, these are so-called socialist Labour lefties, and they're saying, oh, we don't want any independent broadcasting other than the BBC.
Well, because it's commercial and it's beyond the control of government. So, I mean, all governments don't like stuff which is... out of their control, don't they?
So depressing, isn't it? Why don't governments actually foster freedom? Why don't they do that?
Well, you tell me. I mean, that's a big story, the big question that will run and run and run. I mean, all political parties say we're in favour of freedom, we love freedom, we want to free people up from the...
As soon as anyone actually tries to do it, they close them down.
Yeah, indeed, yeah. Just go back to one of your other questions. I mean, you asked about, you know, life on board a ship. You know, is there a problem with storms?
Yes,
there is. There were numerous problems with storms. You know, and in fact, the first Radio Caroline ship, the Mi Amigo, sank.
What sort of ship was it? Was it a sort of freighter or a trawler?
Well, I mean, Radio Caroline actually has had a number of ships over the years, but the two main ones were the Mi Amigo and the Ross Revenge. Now, the Mi Amigo was a sort of 500-ton. I think it was a very old ship. It was... I'm not sure what it was. It was either a small cargo ship or a coaster or something. And it was a wreck.
It just went straight to the bottom.
Well, not straight to the bottom, no.
Slowly.
it broke its anchor and ran aground, and then, you know, it fell over and sank. And so the mast was sticking up out of the sea for months and months.
What about the records and the DJs?
The DJ survives. The records are still at the bottom of the ocean. Not very deep water. If you're a keen diver, there could be a little gold mine for you down there.
Wow, fantastic. You could flog them on eBay and make yourself a mint.
You quite possibly could, yeah. I mean, there's a bunch of very, very die-hard Radio Caroline fans. I don't know if you know, this is an interesting thing. The word anorak has become a sort of general term for a sort of nerdy, train-spottery, ton of geeky sort of person.
Yeah, like you or I,
You speak for yourself. But, I mean, actually, anorak used to refer very specifically to people who were fans of pirate radio, of offshore radio. And there's a number of sort of fans publications like Anorax UK, and that term has been around in that sort of environment for 30 years or more. It's only in the last sort of 10 years it's become a sort of common currency, I think.
Okay, so what about once the first ship, what was it, the Mi Amigo?
Yeah, so that sank in 1980. I mean, just to go back to the Marine Offences Act, what it did, they figured that they couldn't outlaw pirate radio because it's outside British territorial waters where British laws don't apply. So what they can do instead is they can make it illegal for British subjects to supply the station and make it illegal for British DJs to work on the station.
Ooh, that's annoying.
It is, yeah. So in 1967, I mean, there were several pirate stations. It was a real bonanza. It wasn't just Caroline. There was Big L, Radio London, Radio Such, Tower Radio. I can't remember. There's loads of them. Swinging Radio England, even Radio Scotland.
I think I can remember seeing that there was some offshore forts built in the Second World War.
That's right.
And that a radio station actually squatted one of these forts.
That's absolutely right, yeah. I can't remember exactly which station. I think it might have been Radio Such briefly. That became... Oh, God, I can't remember.
But these are basically like oil rigs out
and far in the Thames Estuary. Yeah, yeah.
And yes, they are, yeah. Have a look at them online if you're interested in... Mad places to go and spend weeks and weeks actually just playing records. And...
Well, as they were originally configured, one of them was Shivering Sands Forts, and I think that one's gone now. So you have these structures, about 8 or 9 forts, all linked together by walkways, and those walkways have all gone. So you're now left with a group of independent towers. But... very recently, someone operated a radio station from there, legally, just as a kind of, you know, a historical experiment.
Medium wave or FM?
Medium wave. It's more medium wave. I mean, there's a number of reasons why it was and still is medium wave. FM was around in the 60s, but it wasn't widely used. You know, the vast majority of radios were medium wave or medium wave and long wave. And the pirates did experiment with FM a little, but it didn't go very far. And that's part of the problem, because medium wave signals go a lot further. It wouldn't really be practical. So, you know, you're broadcasting on FM to almost nobody and not going very far. So, yeah, it's medium wave all the way. And in fact, that's one of the reasons why, had the government not introduced these laws against pirate radio would have died a natural death now anyway, because so many people listen to FM and not medium wave. The medium wave stations are pretty much dying, you know.
Also, what about personalities? Because I know once the Marine Offences Act came in and the BBC set up Radio 1, you know, they went on beyond the light programme to set up Radio 1, 2, 3 and 4. But quite a lot of the personalities that have been involved in pirate radio then went on, didn't they, to the BBC?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. The Radio 1 pretty much wholesale hired a whole load of ex-pirate jocks, you know, people such as... So, some of the names are very well-known, like Tony Blackburn and Dave Lee Travis. Some of them less well-known, like Tom Lodge and Keith Skews and a few others, I don't know, some that I've even forgotten the name of. Micah Hearn is another one. But yeah, I mean, that's where... And John Peel was one of them. He wasn't on Radio Caroline, but he was on a pirate station called Radio London. Johnny Walker's very well known. He didn't go straight to Radio 1. He carried on breaking the law as a pirate out there in 1967. And that broadcast, when at midnight on the whatever date it was, August... he went illegal. Apparently half the population was listening in at that point, which is really quite an amazing listening figure.
Well, he's not... Yes, Johnny's an interesting character. I worked with him in London, on Greater London Radio years ago, but he's now on Radio 2, isn't he? I think it's Sunday afternoons.
Yeah,
that's right,
just Sunday afternoons on Radio 2.
So he's still going strong. But you mentioned John Peel there, and I'd just like to play a little bit of John Peel music. This one's called I Was Born Suspicious. When I was born, I was born suspicious. I was born suspicious. At night, without being harassed by the police, they say we all look alike. Well, that's a stereotype. Like P.E. said, don't believe the hype. Now they wanna rough me up and lock me down. They got my face in the crown. Black man with a phone in custody. So now they wanna take my fingerprints and ID. It's not enough, they wanna rough me up and scuff me up. 14 police just to cuff me up. I guess there's no caviar dreams and champagne wishes when you're born suspicious. When I was born, I was born suspicious. I was born suspicious. I was born suspicious. When I was born, I was born suspicious. 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 Right. I was born suspicious. I was born suspicious. I was born suspicious. I was born suspicious. Chili B. Well, let's hear John say that.
Chili B, of course. I couldn't read my own writing. My apologies to him. That's Born Suspicious, the title track from a 6-track CD from Alternative Tentacles.
Rather better having John, I think, doing that, Steve, than
Chili
me.
B, of course, there from the Alternative Tentacles. I mean, it just makes me laugh, the crazy band names that used to come up on John Peel's show.
But also there is something there that's missing from a lot of mainstream broadcasting, isn't it? I mean, the edge to a song like that, it's actually what it's doing is it's shall we say, rocking the boat a little bit. I mean, we're talking about pirate radio. It's a terrible metaphor. But
there's that film as well, The Boat That Rocked, all about pirate
radio.
What's that? You've never seen that?
No.
That was a Richard Curtis film, came out a couple of years ago, and it was fairly loosely based on the history of Radio Caroline. It's not a great film, but I enjoyed watching it because the producers of the film borrowed some equipment from the Ross Revenge. Now, that equipment was prehistoric even when I was using it in the 80s, and they tarted it up and used it in the film, so I was sort of equipment spotting in the film. Oh, there's that mixer, I've used that, you know. So they was using this genuine old ex-pirate radio equipment for the film. Yeah, watch the film, it's quite entertaining, but it's not a great film.
Okay, what about this whole thing of the BBC taking over? How did that go with Radio 1 with all these DJs? Because, I mean, it seems to that maybe what they did was they sort of allowed a little bit of the rebellious side of the characters of these people to carry on for a while, but that slowly dissipated over the years.
Well, I don't know. John Peel carried on right until he died on Radio 1, doing pretty much his own thing, didn't he?
That's right, October 2004. Mm. That's right.
And Radio 1, you know, has been hugely successful since 1967, since it started.
But you don't hear on mainstream radio, you don't hear some of the really challenging stuff that they were coming out with. I mean, it just seems to be a little bit we're mollycoddled slightly.
Well, I suppose it, you know, inevitably being legal, you know, creates, it sort of softens it slightly. I think, you know, that it's what I think made Pirate Radio special was the very presence of these people who were living together on the ship and breaking the law. Technically not. Some will argue it wasn't illegal. It was unlicensed, not illegal. But that made it an adventure, and that kind of rubbed off in a way. It was like a little bit of a soap opera that you were tuning into, I think. And obviously, like I say, if you're on a land-based station with a license, that doesn't quite ring so true.
Yes, I don't think there's such the sense of fun and freedom on the mainstream. I think you're quite right about that. But anyway, what about since then, and the Caroline has continued? The Mi Amigo was going for quite a while.
That's right, yeah. The Mi Amigo sank in 1980, and it was just clapped out and knackered. Then they got a new ship, the Ross Revenge, which is an old trawler which was involved in the Cold Wars. 1,000-ton trawler, really big ship, really, really solidly built.
And I've seen a picture. It's got a massive aerial on the
Well,
top.
It did have a massive aerial, but that
blew off in a storm.
Blew off in a storm, yeah. That lasted about 4 years. A bit of a tragic tale, because it was all down to lack of maintenance, really, and a lack of communication. If they'd sent out the right man to repair it, it would have stayed up. But yeah, it was the tallest ship's mast ever put on any ship. It was absolutely massive, 300 feet tall, and it put out a cracking signal, and that fell down in a storm and in 87, and then that was shortly after the infamous Michael Fish hurricane. And then they jerry-rigged some other masts, which I helped build, and it carried on. But I mean, you know, it was struggling, and I think it would have, like I say, it would have died a natural death anyway, I think.
I mean, people are still listening to that on Medium Wave.
Oh, yeah,
even though... I mean, I used to listen to it.
Well, I mean, in the 80s, you know, when I was involved, it actually did very well. You know, you'd go, you take your sort of secret little ferry, but your fishing boat back to land, and you'd land up in Ramsgate or wherever, and you'd go to the fish and chip shop, and there was Caroline on the radio. You know, it did really well in terms of listeners.
Okay, so what were you up to?
Well, I was a pirate radio broadcaster. You know, I was a DJ, but I also did the engineering stuff as well. I mentioned I, you know, helped build the aerials and I serviced the generators and so on.
What was it like living on a ship, though?
Well, I don't know where to start, Tony. You know, I mean, I would be out there for several weeks at a time. The longest I did, I think, was 3 months.
I mean, did you keep a permanent place on the land as well, or at home?
Were you able to pay
the rent and everything? Because that would be a...
No, I mean, the money was very tight. I got a little bit of money for being the engineer, but the DJs weren't paid. We made the station pay by playing God tapes, amongst other things.
So this was done largely for the love of it, really?
Yeah, it certainly was, yeah. And you know, the listeners are absolutely diehard for
you,
it.
You got good sea legs?
Yeah, I had no trouble at all, you know.
Really?
Yeah, the really weird thing, actually, was stepping back on land. That was the thing that felt really weird. You know, suddenly the ground beneath your feet isn't moving anymore.
And you're looking at those landlubbers.
So, yeah, you don't know what it is.
Ah, Jim Ladd.
Yeah.
Well, but I mean, so you were looking after, what, transmitters? What exactly were you up to?
Well, I mean, there was huge valve-powered transmitters. There was aerials that tended to fall down.
What happens when a valve goes? It's not very easy. Would you have to go and... in your rowing boat, would you?
No, well, unfortunately, we had a few spares on board. The only time one of them went, I managed to find a spare. But you know, you learn to improvise. I'm very, very good at improvising things. You know, you had these sort of 250 kilowatt six-cylinder diesel engines that ran the generators that had to be going, you know, kept running 24 hours, and, you know, they needed an oil change. You'd swap them over, and like I said, the aerial would fall down, and you'd have to repair that, and, you know, it was a never-ending repair job, you know, just to keep this.
So what eventually happened to the Ross Revenge then?
Well, what happened was in 1990, the government further tightened up the laws. The 1990 Broadcasting Act made it illegal. It made it much, much more illegal. The British government basically granted themselves some quite draconian powers to stop pirate radio that were much more draconian than the powers that they had to stop drug smuggling or arms smuggling. You know, it's really quite outrageous. And so basically that was pretty much the end for it. And since then, I mean, the ship then switched off its transmitters and ran aground and got salvaged. And since then, Radio Caroline has done a series of temporary legal broadcasts.
Because I know a few years ago you were in the harbour here in Bristol, weren't you?
That's right, yeah.
With the ship, is it?
No, not with the ship. We couldn't afford to tow it round. But me and another former Caroline DJ mate of mine decided that we'd like to run a radio station just for a laugh, and I contacted the boss of Radio Caroline for some advice, and he said, well, look, you know, call it Radio Caroline, stick it on a ship, and yeah, okay, great. And so we approached the Thekla, and they were very, very welcoming, and so we did that. That was in 1996.
That must have been a bit of a marathon DJing for you, was it?
Well, not particularly, because we, you know,
you had a whole crew, did you?
You had a whole crew, and our crew actually included a guy he may have heard of since called Stephen Merchant, who's done rather well for himself.
No,
yeah,
really?
He was our breakfast DJ, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And also Emma B, who went on to Radio 1, and
so can anybody do one of these little licenses?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. I mean, you need a bit of expertise, a bit of advice, which I'm happy to give. You need a transmitter, but they're very easy to get. You apply for one, and they give you one, pretty much.
Now, what about your show here on BCFM? I mean, is that a little bit like your show you did on Pirate Radio?
Well, I like to think my incredible piratey DJ talents shine through. I don't know, you tell me, you're the impartial.
Well, I think it is a bit, actually. Sort of music, definitely, it's the kind of pirate radio music. But when's it on? Just remind us.
Well, I do two shows on BCFM. I'm on Monday lunchtime 12 till 2. I had to think about that for a minute. And now I'm doing Wednesday drive time, co-hosting with Billy Quain between 5 and 7.
Well, Steve Satan, thanks ever so much for sharing your knowledge and enthusiasm for pirate radio. Long may it last.
Pleasure.
Bristol Community FM is a registered charity, which means we're not for profit, and we're now able to support local business by offering low-cost promotional announcements and adverts about your business or products. You can even sponsor a show, event, or outside broadcast. So why not support the station that supports the communities of Bristol? And contact us today to find out more. BCFM 93.2 FM. Bristol is our community.
And now I'm joined by Julie Beale. Julie's a single mum from North Wales, and her website is getmindsmart.com. Get mind, got to try and pronounce that right so you understand exactly what I'm saying. Getmindsmart.com. Hi, Julie, and welcome to Dialect.
Thank you very much, Tony.
Now, you've been looking into Global Smart ID. What is this?
Global Smart ID is a name that I've applied to it, but it's only got a name that the experts use at the moment, which is Federated ID. They've only just started trying to sell it to the public, but it's not been talked about in the public or aired in the media.
Okay, well, so what's the idea of it?
The idea of Global Smart ID is to identify yourself remotely over the internet for payments, for accessing services online, including government services, because the UK government is about to make all of its services, all of them are going to be online only.
Well, it certainly seems like the government is trying to push everything online. I mean, with this universal credit, that's just one thing, but it seems like a lot of things, they're trying to make everything happen online. Things like accounting, submitting accounts, tax returns, all this kind of thing. So the idea is that you remotely online can identify who you are. So why haven't we heard about this in the news? It's a massive story.
I've absolutely no idea why it's not being aired in the news, especially with all the stuff with the NSA at the moment, because this is going to entail even more profiling of individual people.
So what's the connection, though, Julie? What's the connection between this and the NSA GCHQ story?
Well, sold as something, you know, when they start marketing it, they say, we will protect your identity for you. So it's an identity provider like Google or PayPal or Microsoft, Verizon, Experian. They will look after all of your credentials for you. So everything is digitized, your passport, your driving license, your employment ID, everything will be digitized, the birth certificate, and it's effectively handing all of those things over to an identity provider, and they will authorize your access to things online, including government services.
Well, hang on a minute, because, I mean, surely that may be something the government should do, but surely not private companies. I mean, why should I go to Microsoft in order to guarantee who I am? Because then they're going to, obviously, they're going to start charging for that service. They're going to start having, you know,
They're not going to charge us.
Yeah, but they're charging the government. Rather than do it themselves, the government are privatising this even before it's begun.
Yes, I know, and they're very proud of it as well. It's all about outsourcing. Everything today is being outsourced, and this is yet another thing. All of our government is being handed over to American corporations, and everything is being stored in the cloud, including all of our social ID profiles, which are very, very, very specific.
Well, just give us an idea of how detailed they go, these profiles.
Well, it depends what kind of footprint you've made online. So all the little breadcrumbs, anything you've done, if you've bought something, if you've commented online, anything leaves a mark and it is there forever.
Well,
there are companies now that can sweep it all up, and it's called a social profile or a social ID, and it's used by marketers, and the government is planning to use it for people to access their benefits online, which is coming with universal credit, and this is going to affect me.
Well, why can't we just ignore this?
Because I won't be able to get benefits unless I sign in with an identity provider online, and it's more than likely going to be using biometrics, although in the sense that it will be probably, it's looking like going to the post office with your passport, because that is biometric, or your NHS staff card. So yes, biometrics are enrolled. They tell you that they keep all your information private. Now really, it does become more private, but only in the sense that instead of signing up, or, you know, like if you register with a website and you have to, say if you're going to buy something from someone and you register, instead of doing that, you just click on Google or Yahoo or Facebook and sign in this way. This is what this federated login is. And as soon as you do that, all of your information is shared with all the other people who have got, you know, signed up with Truly You or Jan Rain. Other companies which are aggregating this data, but the actual website owner, instead of having the registration process themselves, outsources it to the identity provider. So the identity provider is a go-between, and it's the website owner that pays for the service. For us, it's free, because they're selling our data.
Amazing. And this really does hook in, doesn't it, very, very closely with all of the data that's being trawled and collected by GCHQ, the Signals Intelligence people, and the National Security Agency. The trouble, of course, is that a lot of information that we are, when we use the internet, particularly maybe our phone as well, that starts to become a valuable commodity, particularly for advertisers.
Extremely. All the power is shifting. It's all private.
And I mean, is there any way, do you think, that to avoid having this? I mean, you mentioned benefits. Obviously, if you need your benefit, you're going to have to buy into this global smart ID.
It's also heralding the disappearance of cash. And I just want to mention that with Bitcoin and things like the Brixton Pound, which it's a community currency.
That's right. These are alternative currencies, aren't they?
Yeah, which obviously I really back all of the principles of them, but you have to picture it as a global system. If any of those succeed on a large scale, then they also require ID authentication online. So it's all about trust. This is the word that goes all the way through. Trust and you know if we have a whole world full of everyone's got a local currency and they're all digital, then you don't know who you're dealing with, and you will have to have this kind of ID authentication system as well. So it's coming at us from all sides, and at the moment the banks are going to be it won't be long until, if you want to make a payment online, and that you'll have to do it by going through an ID provider first, and then not long after that there won't be any more cash, so all transactions will be recorded and auditable, and then everything is stored on a little chip. And at the moment the technology is shifting, either it's going to either be on a smart card or just in your smartphone. So basically the smart cards are until everyone's got a smartphone, and that contains, that little chip, all of your your ability to access your ID online and prove that's who you are. So if that's used for everything, it's just ridiculous that we're turning this society into one that relies on tiny little microchips and a large,
Well, it's a bit Orwellian, Julie, isn't it? And I mean, I'm also a bit concerned because we know that the RFID chips, the radio frequency identification chips, are being used, at least trialled anyway, in schools. And the idea is to get young people used to using these little tiny chip things. No one really knows where can read them. So, kids could be tracked even whilst they've left school if they've got their chip with them. And it's almost like the way to get the society used to using this technology is to actually try and make it attractive to young people.
Yes, absolutely. It is really important to remember where this goes. It's definitely, at the moment, there's no doubt that it's all going into this little chip, and it'll either be in a card or on your phone. So then comes the question of what happens if you lose it or it's stolen. It's so obvious that is, an immediate threat in the very, very near future. And the only option is to have it under your skin. Or, because I've looked into this in some detail, to use biometrics such as ones that monitor your heart rate or brain waves. And those are also technologies which enable ID profiling. There's a lot you can tell just from that, and you can monitor people from a distance.
But amazing, Julie, it sounds like Big Brother is just around the corner. And what annoys me is that there's been so little coverage in the national press over these things, and the technologies are being brought in, first of all, with no legal framework around them, so the people who own those technologies can just simply do what they want, and secondly, with absolutely no consent by the public. Anyway, it's a fascinating subject you've brought up, and brilliant article. When I read your article about this, I thought it was really fascinating. Can you just tell us whereabouts we can go online? Obviously, you've got your own website. It's getmindsmart.com, getmindsmart.com. Where else can we go online to find out more about this?
Well, I found out about it by going to all of the actual companies, having a look through all the conference agendas, reading minutes from meetings, listening to lectures and webinars on YouTube, and I've put up a lot of links on my website. But the only reason I keep on going is because I'm trying to get other people to talk about this. I cannot believe that I seem to be the only one that's going, excuse me, this has got to stop. This has got to change. So if there's anyone else out there, please look at my website. do the research and start telling other people about this, please.
Well, I can say, Julie Beale, is thanks very much for bringing it to our attention. I think you've done a fantastic job, and you're a single mum in North Wales. I'm sure there's lots of other people out there and the media that can take this on into the future.
All of my articles are at activistpost.com as well, so just a thumbs up to them and say thank you very much.
Well, no, thank you, Julie Beale, very much for being on Dialect today.
Thank you so much, Tony.
Representing the entire city, this is BCFM. BCFM 93.2.
And I'm joined now by Jason Yannakopoulos. Hi, Jason.
Hello, Tony.
All right, now we're going to have a look at Private Eye with this wonderful picture of Rebecca Brooks on the front. I'm not sure if we're allowed to talk about Rebecca Brooks since there's this active court case, but one thing we can say is she used to be the editor of the News of the World, and the News of the World is no more. Hooray!
Hooray! Round of applause.
I hope that's not prejudicing a trial. I don't think that is.
No, that's just stating what a piece of rubbish we thought the paper was.
And also, I think it's fair to say that it looks like she may have had a very close relationship with Andy Coulson whilst her husband is stood next to her in the courtroom. That's rather a weird thing to have to be told.
Yes, it was a little bit more than the working relationship. I mean, it was a working relationship, but in more ways than one.
Yes, but it didn't work, apparently. Anyway, getting on to the sort of general theme this evening, I want to start off by talking about the JFK assassination. We had a few weeks ago, didn't we, that Guns and Butter Garrison interview. I wanted to look this week at really the context of the JFK assassination a bit more, because I think when you're getting stuff on the mainstream press about, oh dear, did someone do it, another person do it, it's nice to have a bit of good context. And William Cooper, it's about, well, what is it, it's 50 years since the November 1963 assassination of US President John F. Kennedy, which marked for many the end of freedom in the United States and the beginning of the takeover of the country by the financial elite in the military-industrial complex. A few weeks ago, we played that extract from one of the greatest ever documentaries on the subject. That's the Garrison interview by Californian documentary makers Guns and Butter. Over the next 2 weeks, we'll be hearing, and Jason and I will be discussing afterwards, from another US radio host, though. William Cooper was an ex-naval intelligence officer who had his own FM station and shortwave station based at his home in Arizona. Before his untimely death, just a few weeks after the 9/11 attacks, he actually predicted a massive attack on the United States, which he said would be blamed on Osama bin Laden. Anyway, Bill believed that secret societies following the ancient mystery schools were the real power behind the scenes in many parts of the world. And he was in a position to know, having been right in the middle of the Navy. But we'll leave you to decide on the truth of that by having listened to him. And it was these groups, he said, working within the intelligence services that sacrificed John F. Kennedy on the 22nd of November 1963. So let's have a listen now to the first of these two extracts over the next couple of weeks from William Cooper.
A bolt of lightning struck a tree. The tree burst into flames. Ancient man, if you watch the movie Quest for Fire, rushed up and grabbed one of the burning branches, and it burned his hand, and he let it go. He probably didn't go any farther than that the first time. Second time, he may have found a deer that had been roasted by the heat of the fire in the forest, and being hungry, maybe he partook of some of that meat and found that it tasted pretty good. Also, the fire was warm and didn't get cold at night. And this is where the whole battle between the forces of light and darkness comes from. Man sat upon a rock one night, watching the sunset, and said, "Boy, I'm in deep trouble now. I can't see in the dark. There's wild beasts out there. There's tigers with teeth 7 inches long that want me for dinner. What am I going to do?" He didn't know what to do. Neither would many of us put in that situation. But we would know one thing, we're in deep trouble. And so for a good part of his history, man sat huddled in the darkness in some place that made him feel secure, waiting to be saved. Now remember, folks, I'm not telling you what I believe. I'm telling you what is taught in the mysteries. I'm telling you what our enemies believe.
Make no mistake about it, they are our mortal enemies. They want to see us wiped off the face of the earth. Man huddled in this darkness, fearful, trembling, cold, hungry. And around about he could hear the beasts roaring. And sometimes they were roaring because they were after him. And sometimes he was eaten. A man eventually saw another tree struck by lightning and grabbed that branch with that flame on it. And by a little experimentation, he learned how to keep that fire going. And if he could keep the fire going, he knew something nobody else knew, and he became the first king, the first priest, the first scientist, all rolled into one. And he would burn this fire and keep it going. Another man in the cold of the night, wanting to escape from the terrors that were out there, would gravitate toward this glow, and they would see this man sitting there. And if he was kind, he would let them come to the fire, and they would be warm, and they would be protected, because if the wild beast came, he'd pick up a branch and shove it in its face, and the beast would go away. And so the forces of light overcame the forces of darkness, and in the sunshine of the morning, the newly risen, resurrected child that had died the night before, their Savior, warmed them and saved them from the terrors of the Prince of Darkness. You have to study these things to understand your enemy. Any general who ventures upon a battlefield without understanding the enemy is doomed to defeat. Just like a militia that forms itself upon a peninsula has already created its own concentration camp, unless it has a navy. Damn good militia, I might add. What is the upshot of this? What am I getting at here? These people believe, and they have conducted themselves according to their belief and their philosophy since the very dawn of man. These people learned how to control others through the use of a hidden knowledge. This ability to keep that fire going was a technology that nobody else knew. By observing the fire, by keeping it going, by creating ceremonies around this fire, they became a mystery to the others. A mystery always holds sway over those who don't understand it. And the priesthood was born. No king ever existed without the permission of the priesthood. And I don't care what religion you're talking about or what period of history you're talking about, it is the truth. The kings never had the power, and don't to this day. Kings exist at the whim of the real power, which is the priesthood standing behind the throne. And when the king ceased to be of benefit to the priesthood, they would simply poison him or get rid of him in some other way. The king is dead, long live the king, and there would be another king appointed. There was even a time in history when the king was a sacrificial king, just like John F. Kennedy was in the Temple of the Sun known as Dealey Plaza. They would pick a young man at the height of his virility, appoint him king for 1 year. During that time, he could do or say or command whatever he wanted. The priesthood was always there to make sure he commanded the right things, have any woman that he wanted, and at the end of the year, he was ceremoniously sacrificed upon a rock, his heart ripped out, his body dismembered into 14 pieces and scattered over the land. And this is where the legend of the Osirian cycle began. It was to ensure the fertility of the crops of the next year. And young men would volunteer for this in their patriotic duty
to their kingdom, to their family, so that they could have prosperous years. Much as our young men may volunteer to rush out over the water to a place called Kuwait or Iraq and die in the godforsaken sands of a place that nobody can even find on a map, I never heard of until it happened, all so that he can be called a patriot, someone his family can be proud of. It escapes me how they can ever arrive at these conclusions, but they do, and the priesthood always takes the most advantage of this willingness to sacrifice oneself upon the altar of his country. The problem with it is, it's very seldom really for the country. It's for the advancement of the agenda of the priesthood, whoever the priests happen to be at the time.
Well, that's William Cooper there speaking in Lansing, Michigan, back in 1996, 4 years before he died, just after the 9/11 attacks. He was shot by the FBI because there was a gunfight outside his house just after the 9/11 attacks, which, bizarrely, he managed to predict. So, Bill Cooper, but Jason, without going too much into some of the stuff he's talking about there, he's talking about America not really being run by the president. I mean, what do you think about, I mean, obviously, JFK, he's saying, was sacrificed, but what about Obama? Do you think he's really in charge?
I'd be very surprised if any of the presidents have really been in charge. I think the people in charge are the people who the History Channel put it wonderfully as the men who, well, not so wonderfully actually, as the men who built America. We're talking about Rockefeller, Carnegie, Morgan, Ford and people like that. And I think, especially in the cases of Rockefeller and Morgan and a few of the other ones, Astor and DuPont, people like that, these are the sort of people that have built dynasties, and these are probably the real power behind America, Bush dynasty, etc. These are people that run, that have run, that have been part of and run Federal Reserve.
Yeah, and yes, so the Kennedy assassination, a lot of people say, well, why do people still talk about that? But it was a sort of, I don't know, it was almost like the end of hope in America, because it had been a place where, certainly since World War II, during World War II, before World War II, there had been a lot of, you know, we are going to deal with the problems, this is a real free country. And the people you're talking about who, you know, it does look like really run things over there, they're really the industrialists, the people who stand to profit. And of course the trouble is, of course, they can profit from war,
and I think they are now, I think they realise that war is such, from their point of view, especially Rockefeller who owns Standard Oil, war is such a profitable business for them.
Good to get shares in these companies or not?
No.
Well, this is the trouble, isn't it? Of course, they get the best investments seem to come from the investing in these elite companies. This is the trouble. It's like a, you know, if you're going to actually have a decent pension, your pension fund or whatever has to invest in those companies which actually encourage war. I mean, it's that we've got ourselves into a bit of a fix, haven't we?
It's not a great situation to be in, no.
Okay, anyway, we're going to have a bit more from Bill Cooper last week. The reason I picked up on him, of course, is he's talking there about Kennedy having been actually sacrificed by people behind the scenes. I mean, I know you've mentioned on this show months ago the Rosicrucians, these sorts of peculiar secret societies. Oh, it's yes. Difficult to know what role they have. He certainly is basically, Cooper is saying, that Freemasonry is, it's the... The tradition, is, I mean, the Freemasons, for example, to say that they started in 1717, I say, balderdash, that this kind of thing has been going on for centuries, for millennia even.
Well, actually, it's interesting. There was, I think it was the History Channel covered it, they had a series which is running now, which is called American Book of Secrets, and the first programme they did was on the Freemasons.
Oh gosh! The thing is, of course, that they are basically cults, religious cults, and yeah. their loyalty is to their other people in the cult, not to the rest of us.
Melloc. I think is the name of that.
Okay, anyway, on to the news this week. Starting off with Royal Mail. What's going on with Royal Mail this week, Jason? I mean, I know they've just been privatised. That is, they've been moved from the public sector into the military-industrial complex, if you want, the markets, you know.
Well, this is a point made literally the first article this week in the Private Eye, talking about Vince Cable having said... at the start, 6 months ago, he dismissed tax havens as being sunny faces for shady people. But by privatising Royal Mail, has now been sent a big chunk of that to sunny faces for shady people, effectively. The largest shareholder with almost 6%, around £300 million of shares, is Children's Investment Master Fund, typically aggressive hedge fund that belies its cuddly name. And Talos Capital Limited. The former is a £5 billion Cayman Islands hedge fund, which has funded a charitable foundation bearing a similar name, with a manager located in the island. It earned serious money before passing a fee to the UK management outfit, Children's Investment Fund Management UK, Limited Liability Partnership.
So, ultimately, the Daily Mail is being run out of tax havens and not paying proper tax in Britain.
You mean the Royal Mail?
No, I mean both, actually, because the Daily Mail, too, is Daily Mail and General Trust is.
So must be something about mail, then.
yeah. Also, who is Godfrey Bloom, has he been up to?
Godfrey Bloom is the infamous, formerly high-ranking member of UKIP. This is a man that the bongo land quotes, and was complaining about the idea that women who don't keep behind their fridges are sluts. Well, yesterday he suggested that large numbers of the unemployed and public sector workers should be stripped of their right to vote.
Right. So basically, if you're poor, then you're in the same category as a prisoner or someone who's mentally insane. And therefore, you shouldn't be able to vote. At least that's what the law says at the moment.
Well, that's what Godfrey Bloom is getting.
I mean, what's going on here is a criminalisation of the poor, isn't it, essentially? I mean, you know, the idea that if you're poor, then you... We're going back to Victorian workhouses, Jason.
Well, I think we're going back to the pre-Victorian idea of politics. Sort of almost like the Georgian era of all the politics in the country being run by pocket boroughs controlled by very rich people.
Oh, dear. OK, what about Remploy? There's a story on that this week too, isn't there? Remploy, we had an office in Bristol, Remploy factory, employing disabled people.
They've now all been closed down. The government has long defended its decision to turf disabled workers out of Remploy, supporting by the claim that the factories were ghettos, and that having consulted widely... So people would rather be integrated in mainstream jobs, which is roughly true. But the latest employment figures show how ill-thought the closures must have been. Disability groups and unions have warned that mainstream factory and office jobs were often inaccessible and poorly supported. As the final factory closed this week, statistics confirm that 2/3 of former employee workers whose factories closed last year have still not found work, or did find work, but then lost it. Thus, 1,326 people are now in the unemployment ghetto, in inverted commas, instead.
Well, I think if Ian Duncan Smith had been round to Remploy Centre in Bristol and said this is a ghetto, he'd probably have been lynched because actually it was a lifeline for a lot of people who they didn't feel ghettoised at all. And also it was a whole support network at work for disabled people, which has now been destroyed and costing the taxpayer far more, of course. Some of the Remploy people in Bristol told me on the other show I do on Fridays on Drive Time, they actually felt that the government was being fascistic by closing them down and not a ghetto at all.
Yes, I think there's a large argument to suggest that.
Okay. Jason, you know, you as yourself a disabled person, what are your thoughts about Remploy?
Remploy was useful in the way of they granted long-term a great deal of employment to people with disabilities who maybe may not have got jobs elsewhere. So the people who might not have been picked up by private companies, people who would have been considered as costing too much. So it was quite a good idea.
And it was set up by Winston Churchill after World War II to help people who'd been injured in the war. Indeed. Unbelievable that they should close this. But anyhow, they have done.
BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
Anyway, thanks very much to Jason. That's all for this week. Dialect, your weekly podcast for your MP3 player, produced by volunteers. Broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 11 a.m. every Thursday morning. If you're online, you can subscribe to our RSS feed or email list, which will remind you every Tuesday evening when Dialect goes online. You can do that or download this weekly podcast from Dialect Radio, one word, .co.uk. Dialect's a Bristol Broadband Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. If you'd like to, do please contact us through Volunteering Bristol 0117 989 7733. You'll find them online at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling. Thanks very much to Jason Yannakopoulos there, and I'm wishing you a very good week. Until the next time, goodbye for now.
With a sweet groove, I think.